English radio program.
The top story: Yemen's Ansarullah movement denounces new U.S. sanctions against the group, saying they are an extension to a systematic plan to destroy the Yemeni economy. France announces a drawdown of its forces in Africa's Sahel region amid anger over its military presence, which has been slammed as a colonial throwback. International charity group Oxfam criticizes the group of seven rich countries for their poor contribution to global coronavirus vaccination campaign. Hello everyone, my name is Arash Zahedi. Welcome. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has denounced new U.S. sanctions against the group as a new crime against the Yemeni nation. A member of the Supreme Political Council of Yemen said the United States is putting the war option as its first priority while pretending to seek peace. Muhammad Ali Al-Houthi said imposing sanctions to bring peace will lead to nowhere. He stressed that the new measures are an extension to a systematic plan aimed at destroying Yemen's economy. The U.S. announced its new sanctions against Ansarullah on Thursday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. will continue to exert pressure on Ansarullah to make it end their offensive in Ma'arib. Ansarullah and its allied army units are engaged in a battle to liberate the city from Saudi-backed forces. Political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says the U.S. imposes sanctions on Ansarullah because the movement threatens Washington's policies in the region.
The United States is using the blockade as well as the weapons, and for them to put more sanctions on Ansarullah, I don't think this actually will make any difference on Yemeni army advance toward Ma'arib or any coming attack against Saudi Arabia. But as Muhammad Ali Al-Houthi said, to force sanction on one side to seek peace, this actually will get you nowhere, because we remember that when Trump administration in the final days, they have put the entire movement, Ansarullah movement, as a terrorist group. This actually has not changed anything. Those sanctions actually is because Ansarullah is against U.S. Foreign policy, and because it shows that Ansarullah is the only group in Yemen that's actually threatened the U.S. and the Zionist and the Saudi policy in the region. Right. And this actually is a kind of honor for them to be sanctioned by the United States.
International charity group Oxfam has criticized the group of seven rich countries for their poor contribution to efforts to inoculate the world against COVID. G7 members are set to begin a three-day summit on Friday. They're expected to agree to donate 1 billion COVID vaccine doses to poorer nations. That is according to the UK government. Now, Oxfam and other campaign groups have condemned the plan as a drop in the ocean. Oxfam says the summit will be a failure if the best G7 leaders can manage is to donate 1 billion doses. It says the world would need 11 billion doses to end the pandemic. Oxfam has also called on G7 leaders to support a waiver on the intellectual property behind the vaccines. Venezuela says it has been unable to complete payments to COVAX. So that is the global COVID-19 vaccine program, mind you, because the payments were blocked.
Completa.
Venezuela paid the full installment required by COVAX, but the last four payments amounting to $10 were blocked, and this is how COVAX informs us, where it says, in relation to the four payments mentioned, I confirm that we have received a notification from UBS Bank that the payments have been blocked and are under investigation.
Venezuela's vice president has blamed the U.S. She said the U.S.-backed financial system has the power to block resources that can be used to immunize the Venezuelan nation. The country is now denied access to 11 million doses of COVID vaccines. Caracas secured them in March after months of diplomatic efforts. Venezuela has also used Russian and Chinese jabs to make up for vaccine shortages caused by financial restrictions. hoods by the U.S. Latin American nation has reported more than 246,700 COVID cases, nearly 2,800 deaths. Commentator Mr. Barry Grossman says that the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela cause irreparable damage to the lives of people.
Anyone who thinks that U.S. sanctions are intended to inconvenience and target the political leadership really needs to think again, because we've seen time and time again that the United States doesn't bat an eye at taking the fight directly to the people of the nation using tactics which very often cost many, many, many thousands of lives. And we're seeing it again with this. On the one hand, the U.S. claims to be the global leader in fighting this unusual pandemic. And on the other hand, we see them insisting on making sure that everyone pays top dollar for their vaccines. They refuse pretty much to recognize any vaccines that don't originate from them or one of their European allies. And they're quite intent on blocking access to vaccines on the part of people in countries which the U.S. maintains a comprehensive program of sanctions against. All of which is clearly outrageous, and their hands are, as you point out, drenched in blood one more time.
It's time for our news review. Welcome. France has announced a drawdown of its military operations against militants in the Sahel region of Africa.
The desired result is obviously to reduce our multiple hooks, to reduce the logic of external operations, to keep two pillars. One pillar, the fight against terrorism with the special forces structured around Takuba, obviously with a strong French component, with several hundred soldiers and African, European, and international forces at our side, but with a vocation to carry out strictly counter-terrorism interventions and with far fewer hooks.
Macron said France's operations in West Africa would come to an end and be merged into a broader international mission. France currently has 5,100 troops in the Sahel region that encompasses several African countries, including Mali. The presence of French forces in the Sahel is rejected by some politicians and locals as a colonial throwback. In January, Malians protested in the capital, Bamako, against France's military presence in their country. Thousands of soldiers and civilians have died in the Sahel conflict over the past years. More than 2 million people have been displaced. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in a panel to join me. Mr. Mustafa Traore is an academic and political commentator out of the French capital of Paris, as well as Mr. Alex Powers. He is an African affairs analyst out of Douala in Cameroon, also via Skype. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. I'm going to begin with perhaps some reaction out of Paris through Mr. Traore, please.
It is a starting point, which means that this is what Malians were asking for a long time. They were asking for the withdrawal of the French army from...
Sir, would you hold the microphone a little bit closer to your mouth so we can hear that?
So, yes, I was saying that this is a starting point. It is something that most Malians are pleased with, the fact that the French army is going to withdraw from Mali. And it is the end of the Barkhane mission. So this is the starting point. But what Malians are asking is not the transformation of this initiative into a new one. What they're asking for is the complete withdrawal of the French army from the Malian soil. There is no justification for the French army to be in Mali. We do not know what they are looking for. We do not know what their objectives are. The French army is in Mali, and this is without the consent of the French parliament, which means that nothing was voted in the French parliament. It is not in the Malian soil. It is not on the Malian soil with the consent of the Malians, because no law was passed in parliament, in the Malian parliament, so that the French could be on the Malian soil. So it means that it is not legitimate. The French presence in Mali is not legitimate. They want to exploit the resources. That's the first objective of the French. So they use the pretext of terrorism to justify their presence. But we know that those who provide the terrorists with weapons, with technology, with money, are the same people who say they are trying to fight against them.
Mr. Powers in Douala, to what extent do you share that idea of Mr. Traoré? He says that he wonders what the French troops are actually doing in that part of the world, and their objective is unclear, yet their presence is illegitimate. To what extent do you share that idea?
Well, I mean, French foreign policy has always been to enforce their colonial rule, post-colonial rule. They have control over the finance. They have agreements. Most of the French African countries, this is the zone we're referring to, has about 17 countries. And Mali's really well known for their gold reserves. They probably have the world's largest gold reserve that we know. And, you know, France needs that reserve. It's the same reason why they're in the Central African Republic, uranium, other minerals, but mainly gold, uranium. These are strategic minerals that France can't really afford to lose. In addition, you know, remember the Americans had an incident in Mali as well. So it is a good question why exactly they're there. I know there is, you know, the Boko Haram, you know, the Al-Shabaab type movements are in those regions. But, you know, I think personally in Africa, I think foreign governments should probably avoid these kind of guerrilla warfare scenarios. We're not, you know, traditional militaries really aren't designed for that. And it's shown throughout, even here in Cameroon, where Cameroon government forces are having a hard time containing, you know, rebel forces. So, you know, getting back to Mali, I think Mali has, you know, other than the currency peg and their traditional colonial rule type deal, you know, France is pretty much everywhere in their countries. I mean, they really haven't left. They have their bases, and, you know, they just, they always negotiate it diplomatically and figure it out.
Okay. Mr. Traoré in Paris, in what light do you think should we perceive what President Macron has said about the drawdown of forces? Should we give him perhaps the benefit of the doubt and think that this is out of goodwill, or perhaps, if not out of goodwill, something good will actually come out of this decision? Or do you think this is not the case? In what way do you think we're going to witness the developments in that region from this point forward?
There are many things. The first reason why Macron made this declaration is because there are French elections coming soon, and people, the French people, cannot understand what the French army is doing in Mali. You also have lots of protests going on in Mali, people asking the French army to leave. If every day you got some demonstrations in Mali that are not covered by the media, the international media. And we know that there was a coup, a military coup, something like 2 or 3 weeks ago in Mali. They got rid of the president and prime minister. The army got rid of the prime minister and the president because they were too soft with the French. So now you got Assimi Goïta, the president, and so he does not want France to interfere in the country the way it used to do it under the former president. You've got also the new prime minister who was nominated, Sergei Maïga, who is he was educated in Russia, and he wrote many books about the situation in Mali, and he's also known to be against the French intervention on the Malian soil. So these are the reasons why that Macron decided to change the system, by putting an end to the Balkan mission and trying to transform it into something different that will be maybe more international. So France cannot remain in Mali because it's not wanted. What they're trying to do now, they're trying to invite other European countries so that they can better exploit and get their objectives in Mali, which is just exploitation, and making sure that all the resources they want to get from the Africans in Niger, Mali, Burkina Faso can be extracted without any risk, because we know that if there is no security, it's more complicated for them to extract the resources. So it is a very tricky game they're playing at. First, they are financing and providing the terrorists with weapons, with technology, so that there is instability in the region. And at the same time, they use this system to better extract, exploit the resources.
Many, many thanks, Mr. Alex Powers, African Affairs Analyst out of Douala, as well as Mr. Mustafa Traore, Academic and Political Commentator out of Paris. And thank you for being with us for this edition of News Review. And that's it with international news.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Concern with most Iranians at the moment is to put bread on the table and the possibility of once again planning a future. That is what they expect of the future president. It would make for their criteria for voting. Iran's to elect itself a new president and top politician in less than 2 weeks. But it appears any of the seven candidates getting in will find his main challenge to be economic rather than political. For a look into Iran's multifaceted economy, economic challenges, and possible solutions, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Whatever plans the different candidates have for different economic issues would make or break them in the presidential race. Issues are inflation, poverty, unemployment, and skyrocketing prices for basic household goods. Principalists or conservatives blame problems on the Rouhani administration's looking to the West to solve the country's economic woes. The question today is, what will they, the candidates, bring to the table? Dr. Shaghoghi is Dean of Khwarazmi University's Faculty of Economy. He came to share his views with us at Press TV Studios.
Any cabinet that will take office would face these problems and challenges, which have escalated compared to the previous decade. As time passes by, the problems worsen. Another point to mention is that all the think tanks are predicting by 2030 no country would buy oil. This means an end to the oil exports era.
Dr. Raghfar is an economist teaching at Al Zahra University, where we met him. He mentions the main reason for a high inflation rate.
The main reason behind the rise of inflation in Iran is what's called the costs push, which is mainly caused by currency manipulation. Iran's inflation has ranged somewhere about 14 to 15%, when there haven't been wild fluctuations in the value of our national currency. But in the past 8 years, the inflation in Iran averaged 24%. The highest inflation level was recorded last year at 50%. It was mainly caused by the devaluation of the national currency, as I just mentioned.
Hassan Rouhani didn't inherit a bed of roses when he started out as president in 2013. International sanctions had been tightened in 2011, and inflation was at over 30%, and there appeared no way out but to negotiate a deal with the world's economic powers. That would be the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal with the P5 plus 1, the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. They would lift the UN's nuclear-related economic sanctions off this country in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. The U.S. pulled out, however, in 2018, and made things worse for this country.
The 11th government took office with a promise to solve Iran's nuclear-related issues, lift sanctions, and improve the country's international ties. But the nuclear negotiations that were expected to be wrapped up fast took about 2 to 2.5 years to conclude. Even after JCPOA was reached, several issues, including banking relations, were left unsolved. The government put all its eggs in the basket of the nuclear deal.
Although it may not be tangible, the Rouhani government is said to have kept the economy afloat, when it could have actually drowned by U.S. sanctions, the oil revenues frozen abroad, and the COVID-19 pandemic. Not sure our Dr. Raghfar agrees.
It appears to me that we have all the resources to fund the public sector, but there isn't a political will to get that done. The fact that the government hasn't turned to taxes and that Iran's tax system is flawed and inefficient depends on how much they fit the interests of the decision makers.
Now, Iran's problem is indeed also corruption and mismanagement, not just external sanctions. Whatever weakness or malice and vice the government may have, it is not the ultimate force in the country to carry all the blame. The government needs tax revenues it cannot extract from the most powerful institutions or invisible incomes. It attempted selling bonds for public companies and enterprises, but those basically didn't land in the palms of actual private companies and investors who get the industry running and so create jobs. Dr. Hakhshanas is a prominent economist who was, for his tireless capability, appointed governor of Golestan province when floods swept over the country in 2019. He joined us on Skype.
What the incumbent administration did was, instead of borrowing from the central bank and injecting stronger money into the economy, it attempted to address the budget deficit by selling treasury bills or other securities worth 200 trillion tumans. If the government didn't take this initiative, Iran's economy could sink into hyperinflation, as many experts were predicting following Donald Trump's withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018.
Plenty of solutions suggested by economists, but do any plans and ideas put forth by presidential candidates read with those solutions to economic woes? Let's hear it from an expert. Have you seen any concrete economic plans by the presidential candidates?
I haven't seen any candidate with a comprehensive plan so far. I don't know if they have a plan, but they are yet to publish their agenda through the media or on their websites. The plans have to incorporate the priorities, including those for reforms, operations, how to address major challenges, their quantifiable goals, approaches and strategies. You see, a team of doctors must have a plan that identifies the challenges facing the patient, prioritize which ones to address first, and determines the necessary treatment.
It's come to that time when any guess as to who the next president is can be second-guessed, when the expected outcome can make a U-turn. That's because electoral debates are underway. The first round was on Saturday, the 5th of June, and that was the economic round, when candidates could have recreated their destinies. Overall, the debate between the seven candidates wasn't impressive. Although the seven were to respond to predetermined questions, they basically seized the opportunity to respond to criticisms and attack one another and the outgoing Rouhani administration, or to promote their own plans.
We need to do things like levying taxes on non-productive jobs and at the same time reducing taxes on producers.
When we carefully study the matters, we realize that the government's relationship with the economy and the economies with the people haven't been adjusted. Whenever the government faces a problem, it delves into the pockets of the people.
Dear Iranians, your economic conditions can be improved a lot, but that necessitates reforms that the other candidates can't make. But I have the plan and the ability to do so, dear people.
Unfortunately, in our country, the relevant authorities have become responsible for the protection of foreign currency instead of being responsible for protecting the value of the national currency.
Statistics show that almost 50% of people live below the poverty line. This doesn't befit the honorable people of Iran, that 7 million heads of households don't earn a fixed income and need direct assistance to make a living.
The volume of liquidity is more than 3,500 trillion tumans. This is brought about by banks producing money without the supervision of the central bank, creating super debtors. Currently, there are 11 super debtors who owe the economy 90 trillion tumans.
Before making plans to fight poverty, you need to ensure that you have the attitude for it. Do you have what it takes to fight poverty? One of the problems we have had over the past years has been that the people and the underprivileged haven't been the priority.
But for the better part, the debate circled around criticizing the present government's policies and Abdel Nasser Hemmati's efficiency when chief of the CBI, Central Bank of Iran.
Dear Mr. Hemmati, you have sources to make kingpins for steel, sugar, and cooking oil, but you don't have resources to help the poor. He has destroyed the national currency. Now he's talking about the distribution of poverty. You have distributed poverty.
For instance, Mr. Hemmati said why the FATF hasn't been approved, claiming that you know so much about the issue is why the economy is in the condition it is right now.
Hemmati, for his part, tried to exempt himself from the government's policies, saying Hassan Rouhani lacked economic vision.
First of all, let me say at the outset that I'm not Mr. Rouhani's representative. I was set aside from the central bank because of disagreements I had with Mr. Rouhani. He had the same problem you do. He didn't have economic insight. I urge everyone to consider this. Mr. Raisi said two groups of economists can comment. But if you don't have economic insight, which group do you listen to? It's an issue that's been solved everywhere in the world. Anyone who makes economic decisions must have economic insight.
I asked how Hemmati had won the reputation with many of having kept the inflation and decline of the real under check against all odds. The many don't include our economist.
In an 8-year period, when Iran saw war, occupation, political coup, and other turning points, only once the national currency fell sixfold. That happened in a 3-year period when Mr. Hemmati was in charge.
Mohsen Mehralizade praised the 8-year performance of the Khatami government, calling his own policies a continuation of that reforms government.
People of Iran, all their statistics and political, social, and historical indicators are a testament to the fact that one government managed to advance the country appropriately toward development by moving slowly, steadily, and logically. That was the reformist government of Sayyid Mohammad Khatami.
As for Sayyid Jalili and Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, those were the two candidates that focused on introducing their own plans more than the others did. This means they spent less time on attacking fellow candidates.
You need to be able to create jobs, not add employees. This means that your agricultural sector should be able to do this. We checked how much work can be done in the petrorefinery sector, petrochemical, oil and gas projects, and energy consumption optimization. Also in agriculture, fisheries, farms, animal husbandry, and etc. We have transformative plans for each of these.
We've been making plans with the help of revolutionary youth over the past 3 years under the title of Salam Government. I can address the production barriers, structural budgeting, non-repayment of debts, bank debtors, and tax issues.
In saying why he wanted to leave the judiciary for the executive, Mr. Raisi highlighted his fight against corruption, the source of which he said was mostly the executive, which he wants to reconstruct.
During my tenure in the judiciary, I faced numerous cases which are traced back to the executive branch of the government. I mean legal cases of corruption and economic rights. We investigate these cases with a steady perseverance. People know well that I know no borders in dealing with corruption cases, and it's been proved to them that I'm not all talk. I'm a man of my words. It's a key point that today we need to promptly deal with and correct the branch of the government which is producing such cases.
We popped out to see what people on the street were thinking, how attractive they found the candidates and their mottos. We also asked people whether they associated economic problems with sanctions or domestic mismanagement.
The point is that sanctions have become an excuse for mismanagement inside the country. If they select qualified managers with relevant knowledge and expertise to the area of their activity, we won't have the problems that we have today in the country.
I wish there were more severe laws against presidents who simply forget about their campaign slogans as soon as they win the elections. That's my personal idea, though. Because in that case, they will stay in office for 4 or 8 years and just exacerbate the problems.
For me, who is grappling with problems of life every single day, baseless slogans won't do any good. In fact, we've been able to find ways around the sanctions, but unfortunately, mismanagement is still prevalent throughout the country.
Sanctions will not always be like this. Things will work out. Actually, we need to find a way to cope with mismanagement.
Pressure of sanctions is undeniable, but still the country enjoys enough potentials to flourish. The fact of the matter is that we've heard loads of these slogans since many years ago, but it's not enough. A tongue doesn't get things done.
The administration is pushing to get the U.S. to consent to its demands for sanctions relief before it goes out. After all, it signed the JCPOA in 2015, and it should see that deal's revival through. Before the 2018 U.S. pullout, the Rouhani government even brought the inflation down to around 10% from double that, and kept it that way for 2 years till 2017. But with problems that mounted since 2018, it has attempted solutions that have themselves become problems. For example, to compensate lost oil and other revenues, it minted unbacked money, which it put into the government fund. Printing extra money caused its local currency, the rial, to fall rapidly, fueling inflation.
The reason for the rise in foreign currency prices is the outflow of the currency from the country. In the past few years, economic policies have led to large amounts of currencies leaving Iran, a major part of which hasn't returned. The foreign currencies have been spent to import goods, but not only the goods haven't been brought in, but the money has also been frozen abroad. Much of our export didn't bring in any revenue for the country. Our money was blocked abroad under the pretext of sanctions.
Thanks for your attention thus far. Plenty more coming up. But let's make a quick diversion for a media review in the meantime to see what other outlets have to say. Here it is in words. The BBC reads, Iran's presidential election, four ways it matters, with a look at inflation and high prices. The economy has always played a key role in the Iranian elections, and it is high on the agenda of every candidate. Due to the precarious economic situation, Iran is now in one of its most critical phases since the 1979 revolution. The impact of sanctions exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic has caused one of the worst economic crises in the country's history, with the inflation rate reaching 50%. When the government arbitrarily increased the price of petrol in November 2019, thousands of people took to the streets in more than 100 cities. Although some believe that radical change is necessary and only possible through protests and strikes, there are those who believe that gradual change is more peaceful and feasible through the ballot box. To save the economy is to strengthen manufacture. Tasnim News quotes the leader, Islamic Republic grown stronger than ever. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a live televised speech on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise, emphasized that the key to the Islamic Republic's permanency is in the two words Islamic and Republic. In describing participation in the elections and making a well-informed choice as being the way to solve economic problems, Imam Khamenei added, everyone should consider himself to be responsible for encouraging others to participate, and he or she must participate as well. He stated that participation in the elections is a manifestation of the holy verse, most surely man is in loss, except those who believe and do good, and enjoin on each other truth, and enjoin on each other patience. In saying that the way to save the economy of the country is to strengthen domestic production, the leader of the Islamic Revolution explained, presidential candidates should be committed to combating corruption, strengthening domestic production, and fighting smuggling and unnecessary imports. They must state this commitment today, so that if they do not do this after winning, the supervisory bodies may take them to account. The Financial Tribune counts five major challenges facing Iran's economy. As the seven certified candidates are heading for the June 18th presidential election, Masoud Khansari, the head of Tehran Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, draws their attention to the main challenges facing Iran's economy. When it comes to economy, everything is reduced to livelihood. This is while the livelihood crises arise from underlying macroeconomic factors. The new government should know that Iran's economy is facing five major challenges, which if neglected will bring the country's development to a standstill. He was quoted as saying by the Persian economic daily Donya-e-Ikhtesat. Khansari believes that the next president must have a precise understanding of inflation and its dynamics, causes of capital flight, negative investment growth, reasons behind brain drain, necessity of reforming budget structure, banking problems, insurance, customs, and social security reform, the complex system of sanctions, and the real potential of Iran's economy. Well, that would be it for this segment. Do stay with us. To look at major economic challenges separately, I'll begin with inflation. Or rather, I'll make a second attempt at detailing, beginning with inflation. Inflation has reached annoying levels, such that commodity prices are not exactly stable. They're constantly changing, in fact. It picked up steam in 2018 with the U.S. unilateral pullout and its reimpositioning of U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions, as well as reinforcing and adding to those. Iran has faced the toughest ever sanctions on oil exports and banking since. Unemployment is always top of the list, with breadwinners thinking to vote or not to vote, and for who. To aim for the root of the problem, the root must first be identified. Negative GDP growth due to various problems such as mismanagement, incorrect privatizations, and sanctions has led to the closure of some industries. This, in turn, has led to an increase in unemployment.
Currencies go up so much. Anyone intending to invest would need huge resources to start even a small business. And what the business returns, considering the large amount of investment, taxes, transaction costs, and others, isn't cost-effective at all. That's why we're witnessing unemployment in the country.
If unemployment means a lack of honest jobs, it makes for more alternative ways of putting food on the table. One of the drawbacks of rising unemployment and inflation, as well as sanctions and economic shrinking, is the spread of smuggling, for which it remains to be seen what solutions candidates have.
If the economy is transparent in terms of imports and exports to and from the region, it can certainly reduce smuggling. Smuggling occurs when prices are not realistic. Gasoline is smuggled abroad because it's cheap here and expensive there. It's because the price isn't reasonable. Similarly, home appliances are smuggled inside because they are cheaper abroad.
Sanctions have not brought Iran down. They can't put down a country this resourceful that easily, but they have taken their toll. Sanctions and monopolized revenues have meant the governments have had to make some bad or badder decisions, or decisions with limited usefulness. One of those choices is direct subsidies.
We should frankly admit that people's livelihoods are being threatened. We also need to say that the current conditions have been both caused by the coronavirus pandemic and the sanctions that have impacted all the country's banking and commerce for the past 3 years. This economic condition is a result of those challenges. People are under pressure, but we shouldn't forget the causes.
As corona became a big problem too, the Iranian economy entered a third consecutive year of recession, following the triple shock of sanctions, oil market collapse, and the coronavirus, COVID-19. In response, the authorities unveiled new rounds of cash transfers and consumption loans for lower-income deciles and households without a permanent source of income. Now, COVID-19 healthcare costs and social assistance transfers are forecast to add to the government's expenditure growth. It's noteworthy cash transfers alone would be insufficient, because a rising inflation will mean a reducing real value of those distributed cash transfers. Any sustainability of measures for economic recovery would ultimately depend on reforms, reforms that address the country's structural challenges. One of the structural problems of Iran's economy has been its reliance on oil export revenues. In recent years, the government was blessed by having to reduce its reliance of the public budget on oil economy due to external pressures, due to sanctions, that is. With electoral debates going on, question is, what do candidates plan to do to further reduce this reliance on oil? That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. But do remember, election day is 18th June, and the story is ongoing till then, continually, with special editions as well. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام بني الإسلام على خمسة دعائم: إقام الصلاة، وإيتاء الزكاة، وصوم شهر رمضان، وحج البيت الحرام، والولاية لنا أهل البيت.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, Islam has been founded on five pillars: the establishment of prayer, the giving of the alms tax, the fast of the month of Ramadan, the pilgrimage to the sanctified house or Kaaba, and the acknowledgement of our guardianship, the Ahlul Bayt.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we have many beautiful dialogues in the historical texts of the Muslims and the historical books of the Muslims. We find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth divinely appointed Imam, spoke about a whole host of different things. But one of the things that he talked about, and perhaps we could say he emphasized, was Islamic social etiquettes or Islamic rules of behavior. Now, these rules of behavior, these rules and this social conduct, these etiquettes, are not something negative. They're not something to control human beings. Rather, these are Islamic etiquettes which have been put forth in order to perfect humanity, in order to create a peaceful, stable, happy, satisfactory, joyous, cheerful society. Now, in one of these conversations, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam talks about some qualities which the Shia, the followers of the 12 Imams, have. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir says to his companion that when the Shia become angry, they do not do wrong. And when the Shia, our Shia, the Shias of the Ahlul Bayt, the Shias of the Holy Prophet, the Shias of the household of the Holy Prophet, when they are pleased, they do not exceed, they do not go too far in pleasure. It is such a beautiful conversation here, and there are such beautiful words from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, because truly, when a person becomes angry, they lose self-control, and then they just do anything that impulsively comes to them, right? They become angry, they might hit somebody. They become angry, they might start using swear words and obscene language. They might get angry, right? They might start throwing things and breaking things. Here, Imam al-Baqir says, no, the true followers of Islam, the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt, the Shia, the followers of the family of the Holy Prophet, when they become angry, they do not do wrong. They remain patient until the anger subsides. And on the other hand, when they are pleased, when they are happy, when they are joyous, when they are cheerful, the Shia, the true followers of Islam, they do not exceed the limits, right? Sometimes when we become really happy and we become really, you know, excited, we end up going too far. We'll make a joke that is inappropriate or is bad joke, or perhaps we will tease somebody, or a whole host of different things that happens when a person is too excited, it is too happy, they're too cheerful, right? They also lose control, just like they lose control when they become angry. Imam al-Baqir here, he says to his companion, no, even when our Shias and our followers are pleased, they are happy, they are joyous, they do not exceed the limits. Moderation, the middle path, the path of Islam. Beautiful words in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Imam al-Baqir had an impact on the entirety of the Muslim community. It is true and obvious that those who accepted him as an Imam al-Muftarad al-Ta'ah, someone whose commands and orders needs to be obeyed, those who saw the Imam as someone who knows the knowledge of the Qur'an and the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet and the previous revelations by divine decree and God giving it to him, obviously they would benefit more from such a person, because anything he says, whether he says, I heard my father from his father from the Prophet, or he didn't say that, they know it is from the same source. And so it's all reliable and it's all authentic. Those benefited more. The companions, Abu Hamza al-Thumali, who was a companion of Imam Zain al-Abidin and then the companion of Imam al-Baqir, he was able to benefit more from this man. Others who weren't were impacted and influenced on a lower scale, but they were still impacted and influenced. The circles of scholars that developed in Medina and the circles of scholarship, discussions, talk of different understandings of what the Prophet has said, what is the ruling in Islam, that becoming a discussion in itself, and it becoming important for people to identify what the actual Islamic ruling is, that itself is very valuable, and that's the impact of what Imam al-Baqir did, in addition to all of which he shared of the Sunnah of the Prophet, which was documented, much of it, in the books of hadith. Of those who don't identify as Shia, you do find these ahadith, which are generally sayings of the Prophet that Imam al-Baqir has shared. This is why he's given the title.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.